4. Being tall made me stand out a little, but it was my bulk that drew nervous, sidelong glances on the bus. I'd taken to sitting on the back row, taking up half of the available space. No one came near me. I had drawers full of tracksuits at home which still fitted. Back when I was fat, they were snug around the middle, and I'd have to roll up the cuffs at the wrists and ankles. Now they were too short, and I had threaded new elastic through the waist to stop them falling off. I trawled the charity shops and soon had a utilitarian, if ugly, wardrobe. Away from Tilkley, I formed a habit of walking with shoulders hunched, legs slightly bent. This gave me an odd rolling gait, not unlike the slowed-down Charlie Chaplin. I'd noticed steroid-pumped bodybuilders walking the same way, so I hoped people would assume I was spending too much time in the gym. It seemed to work. The looks I got now were often a mix of guarded amusement and pity. My morning run was followed by the leap over the fence. I was getting better at landing, often coming out of a roll with my momentum pushing me back onto my feet. I sometimes imagined how good that might have looked had there been anyone around to see. There were 3 buildings in the park, ugly 80s design plasticky offices. On the second day, I broke into all of them. I'd packed a hammer and nails along with my sandwich so that I could put back the sheets of wood I removed from the windows. At the end of the third day, I found that I could push nails through wood with my thumb. I stopped bringing the hammer. All 3 office blocks smelled bad, but one of them had fewer rats, so I used it as my base. It was also useful due to some of the items left behind. There was a pallet stacked high with bricks and 20 bags of hardened cement. The stairs were bare concrete and led up to 3 further floors, all empty. I'd spend 20 minutes every morning running up and down the stairs as a warm-up, 3 bags of cement across my shoulders. The best room in the building was just off the reception area. Behind a closed door with a sign saying Manager was a carpeted, furnished office. When I first opened the door, I couldn't understand why it was there, in an otherwise bare and unfurnished building. It was carpeted, for a start. There was a large desk, a faux-leather director's swivel chair, 2 other chairs, curtains, 3 lamps, a telephone, ancient computer, fax machine, filing cabinet, and a hat stand. When I looked closer, I discovered the room was the Tilkley equivalent of a show home. It was supposed to sell the business park to prospective companies. I'm sure the reception area would have been next on the list for the tarting up treatment. The computer, a massive block of a thing, was a fake, as was the fax machine. The telephone handstand was glued to the base. The desk drawers didn't open. I only sat on the chair once. It collapsed. The metal filing cabinet was the best find. I carried it out of the office and set it down in the middle of the reception area. It was empty, but the drawers still opened and closed. I could lift it easily over my head. I made it harder for myself by putting 2 bricks in each drawer before lifting it again. Still easy. I kept adding bricks until each drawer was full. 24 bricks in total. About 3 kilograms per brick. 72 kilograms plus the weight of the filing cabinet itself. Call it about 80 kilograms. Or 12.5 stone. Which I could perform 30 overhead presses with before feeling the burn. And I was still getting stronger. After the first few days, I made a mistake. A stupid one. I'd skipped breakfast, grabbing a banana and some crisps on the way out. At Tilkley, halfway through the weightlifting session, I ran out of steam and felt dizzy. I put the cabinet down and sat on the stairs, breathing hard, feeling sick. I was hungry, really hungry. I wolfed down the banana and crisps and stood up to try again. This time, I lifted the cabinet halfway over my head before the dizziness came back. I dropped it with a crash that echoed for 30 minutes. I sat down again. I waited for about an hour, but I was still feeling shaky, literally. When I held up my hand, I couldn't keep it still, My mouth was dry. I'd finished the bottle of squash I'd brought. It might seem obvious that I wouldn't be able to expend crazy amounts of energy without putting crazy amounts of calories into my body. But it was only at that moment, head swimming, that I made the connection. Stupid boy. I decided to go home. That was when my problems really started. When I got to the fence, I knew I couldn't summon enough energy to jump it. For a few moments, I stared dumbly at the trees beyond, thinking I would be trapped there until someone rescued me. Then I remembered the pallets in the office block. I turned back. It took me over an hour, slowly walking between the fence and the building, dragging pallets through the window and stacking them by the fence. All my limbs were heavy, and my brain's functions seemed slower. I could only focus on the next thing I had to do. Walk to the office, get a pallet, drag it to the window, push it through, drag it to the fence, put it on top of the other pallet, walk back to the office. The hunger I felt was like nothing I'd ever experienced. It was as if I hadn't eaten for a week. Combined with the lethargy and the lightheadedness, I doubted if I could even climb the pallets I'd stacked. After a rest of a few minutes, it was clear my physical condition couldn't improve until I'd eaten. The hunger was all-consuming, a need so powerful it was pushing everything else out of my mind. I couldn't wait. I had to get over the fence before the last of my strength went. I knew I had one shot. If the first attempt failed, I would have to drag myself over the front gate and start yelling, which would lead to lots of questions I didn't want to answer. I'd better make the first attempt count. Without stopping to think about it, I climbed the pallets, hauling myself forward and up with all the strength I had left in my arms and legs. When I reached the penultimate pallet, I shoved the top one forward so it pushed up against the fence, resting against the razor wire. I stood, my whole body trembling. I think I knew there was no way I would make it. But I took one deep breath, and I ran. My trainers pounded up the pallet, too slowly. I would make the top, but I wouldn't clear the wire. One shot. I jumped. Well, it was more of a stumble. I fell forwards and landed squarely on the razor wire. My weight shifted and I heard my clothes ripping. I passed out.
Chapter 6. June 11th, 1978. I admit it, I normally resent the fact that our quarterly meeting always takes place on a Saturday. It's the one day I normally have entirely to myself. Shopping, lunch with a couple of the girls, maybe a hot date later. Ha! In one of those parallel universes Father was speculating about, perhaps, but, sad to say, not this one, of course. If I'm not home to cook for him, he won't eat. He'll still drink, though, and at least when I'm around, I can water down the whiskies. That sounds bitter. I'm not. I'm really not. It's just that I have this ridiculous feeling that I've missed all the opportunities life may have thrown my way. I missed an education. Abos turned out not to be the world-changing scientific discovery we'd all hoped for. Romantically, I feel like I've been left on the shelf. I'm only 27, but I feel older. The few relationships I have been with older men, two of whom turned out to be married. Is this going to be the pattern of my life? Today, I even caught myself looking at Roger and wondering, what if? After what he did? I know. I'm furious with myself. But I promise to be honest in this diary. For the past 6 years, I've only seen him 4 times a year, and he's always been on his best behaviour. He's married now. 2 kids. His hair is receding. I wouldn't be surprised if he's bald by the time he's 40. But he still has a twinkle in his eye when he looks at me. And I still get butterflies. Hopeless. Luckily, he made such a scene today that I think he might even be asked to leave the team. Well, that might be best for everyone. It all started as usual. Father delivering a report on the last quarter. It's a bit of a joke, really, as nothing has ever changed, but we all nod along and make notes. Then Roger stood up and said he had a suggestion. We have been sitting on this for the best part of a decade without any progress. Who knows what secrets lie inside that container? The fact that the best scientific minds have been unable to find a way to penetrate this unknown material suggests that a treasure trove of new science might be our reward once we find a way in. No, I've been speaking to Hopkins. That's Lieutenant Colonel Hopkins these days, of course. He hates it when I still call him Captain. Naturally, I try to do it as often as possible. He really is an awful man. And he is willing to sign off on some new attempts to penetrate the container.
New attempts?
McKean's head shot up like a Scottish terrier spotting a rabbit.
What the hell is that supposed to mean? We've tried everything.
Not quite. I could see McKean's complexion darkening. He stood up too, jabbing his finger at Roger.
If you mean what I think you mean, you stupid Yank, you better bloody think again.
Roger smiled as if McKean amused him, which was guaranteed to wind him up. It worked, of course. McKean has a short temper at the best of times. I could see him grit his teeth. Roger walked over to Abos and looked down the cylinder. Hopkins agrees that our best chance is a controlled explosion. He can provide the expertise necessary and we will oversee the attempt. I suggest starting with 25 grams of PE4, increasing in 10-gram increments until we have a result. McKean had followed him over to the cylinder and was now jabbing his finger towards Abos.
What part of my initial assessment of this substance confused you?
Is there a problem, Pete? McKean dislikes being called Pete. He will allow Peter, occasionally, but has always made it clear he wants to be addressed as McKean. When he ignored this jibe, I realized just how angry he was. He spat out his next words, glaring at Roger.
Let me make this nice and simple for you without any long words. This substance, Abos, if you like, is alive. Alive, Sullivan, living, changing, possibly conscious.
Oh, don't be ridiculous. Roger laughed in his face. McKean clenched a fist.
How dare you have the gall to call yourself a scientist? Abos doesn't conform to your expectations, doesn't resemble anything remotely familiar to us. It is new. It is unknown. We cannot apply our paradigms to a being utterly unlike anything ever classified in the history of our planet. This could be a new species of plant or animal or... oh, well, who knows?
McKean's vocabulary often fails him when he's angry.
Who knows?
Roger was mocking him.
And you're lecturing me on how to be a scientist? Yes, I am.
McKean was spluttering now.
The scientific mind should be curious and humble. Always curious so we can advance our knowledge, but humble enough to know we know nothing.
That was so eloquent, considering the rage he had worked himself into, that I suspected he was reciting something he'd written in one of his books. I did try reading one once. A bit too dry for me. Roger was angry too, I could tell, but he's the sort of man who hides it and seems to get more and more calm. On balance, I think I prefer McKean's red-faced rants. At least we all know how he feels. The two men were on either side of the cylinder now. Roger leaned across and patted the container as if it were a family pet.
No point in being uptight about it, Petey. It's a done deal. I discussed it with Hopkins this morning.
I was aware of Father bristling beside me. Roger saw it too.
I'm sorry, Professor Lothester, I really am, but we're getting nowhere. This is the last chance saloon. If we don't get a look at this baby soon, we can kiss the whole project goodbye. Hopkins pretty much told me as much.
He thinks the military should take over completely, and now he's in charge? That's exactly what he's going to suggest to our paymasters. We were all quiet then. Roger saw the silence as acquiescence. He patted the container again.
Next week, we're moving Abos to a reinforced chamber designed for bomb tests. Then we're going to slap some explosives on it, and finally we'll get to meet our friend here up close and per-
He stopped talking because McKean punched him in the nose. It's the first time I've ever seen anyone get punched, and it's actually pretty disgusting. There was a sickening sort of crunching sound, and Roger's face suddenly changed shape quite horribly. His nose was broken, and blood spurted out all over his chin, through his fingers as he brought his hands up to his face, and all over the container. There was a shocked pause, then Roger started screaming obscenities at McKean. He shut up again just as quickly as the act of speaking was obviously causing a lot of pain. Father, Mike, and I were standing now, and, wouldn't you know, it naturally seemed to fall to me to do the nursing, as it would seem that men are incapable of going near an injured colleague. Women's work, apparently.
As it didn't really seem the right time to take a stand for the feminist cause, I led Roger out of the room to the first aid cupboard and cleaned him up. Thankfully, he had very little to say for himself, other than,
"Ow!"
which he said quite a lot. I may have been slightly less gentle than he would have liked. Oh, well. The meeting was pretty much over then, but Father made an appointment to see Hopkins on Monday. He hadn't actually said whose side of the argument he was on, and I was worried enough that he might have some sympathy for Roger's suggestion that I didn't ask. One very strange thing. As I was getting my coat, Mike caught up with me. He'd been cleaning up the mess in the lab. He looked confused.
"You saw what happened, right, Chris? The blood went everywhere, yeah?"
I nodded. It seemed like at least half a pint had gone down Roger's shirt.
"Well, I mopped plenty up from the floor, but, well..."
Mike flicked a strand of hair from in front of his glasses. He still loves that late 60s Lennon look. He took a breath.
"Chris, there was no blood on the container."
I frowned at him. "Well, yes, there was." I clearly remembered the spray of blood spattering the cylinder.
I know there was, but not now."
He grabbed my hand and led me back to the lab. I stood next to Abos and peered down through the transparent container at the familiar green-blue slime. Mike was right. There was no blood at all. It had disappeared. June 13th, 1978. Everything's changed. Everything. McKean was right. Abos is alive.
Chapter 7. When I came round, it was getting dark. I could hear a rustling noise underneath me. Something had woken me. Then it came again. A high-pitched shriek. I blinked a few times. The hunger was, if possible, even worse. I had passed out on a bed of razor wire, suspended 12 feet from the ground. And all I could think about was food. The rustling noise again. Underneath my uncomfortable perch, a fox was ripping a rabbit apart, shaking its head from side to side as it tore the smaller creature's throat. Part of me recoiled in disgust, while the rest of me silently screamed,
"Dinner."
It was the motivation I needed. With every bit of willpower I possessed, I rolled my aching body sideways towards the forest. The fence creaked alarmingly as my clothes tore still further. The fox sprinted back to the trees a second before I dropped like a stone. An extremely heavy stone in a shredded tracksuit. I hit the ground hard, making a small crater. When I turned my head, I could see the twitching body of the rabbit. With no conscious thought, my hand shot out and pulled the dying creature to my mouth, my teeth closing on its throat, just as the fox had moments earlier. I ate it. Fur, bones, and all. Almost immediately, the lightheadedness receded and some energy returned. I sat up. Looking down at my tracksuit, I winced. The top was sliced into ribbons in places, and there were deep tears in the bottom. I dreaded to think what I would find when I looked at my skin. Gingerly, hardly daring to look, I unzipped the top. The t-shirt beneath was similarly lacerated. I lifted it and looked at my skin. Nothing. Well, a red mark here and there, as if my shirt was too tight. No blood, no wounds, no cuts. It wasn't just speed and strength, then. My skin was impervious to razor wire. I prodded my belly. It was hard, muscled, but it felt like regular skin, elastic, warm, hairy. I stood up. I needed to get home. Eating the rabbit had helped, but I could still feel dizziness hovering at the edges of my consciousness. I would need a lot more sustenance, and soon. I walked towards the road. My stacked pallets would only be seen if someone walked the perimeter of the site. I could catch an earlier bus the next morning and clear away the evidence. I wanted to keep my training ground secret. Half a dozen people were waiting at the bus stop. An old man caught sight of me as I walked out of the shadows, yelped a little, and moved to the far end of the shelter. When I saw my reflection in the glass, I understood why. The ripped tracksuit combined with the rabbit blood around my mouth and on my hands made me look like an escaped murderer. Still, I had no choice. I had to catch this bus if I was going to get home. I stayed at the edge of the shelter and wiped my mouth on what was left on my sleeve. My fellow travelers huddled as far away from me as possible. There was a puddle just beside me. I knelt and washed my hands. When I straightened, at least 4 people were staring.
Fell off my bike,
I said. They kept staring.
It's being repaired. Buckled the wheel.
Someone nodded. It sounded plausible. The body language of the other passengers relaxed a little. I glanced at my watch 5 more minutes before the bus was due. That was when I saw the kebab. It was sitting at the top of the bin, half eaten, bits of lettuce sticking out of the pita bread. Food. My brain turned off again, and I staggered over to the bin. The other passengers flinched. I'm sure I heard a whimper from one of them, then froze as they realized they had backed themselves into the corner of the shelter. Ignoring everyone else, I grabbed the kebab and ate it in 3 bites, including the paper it was wrapped in. It had gone quiet. I turned and looked at some very frightened faces. There was a schoolboy staring at me, a Mars bar halfway to his mouth. He slowly handed it over and scuttled back. I nodded my thanks and threw it in after the kebab. "Thirsty," I croaked. An old lady shuffled forwards, reaching into a shopping trolley and pulled out a thermos.
"Tea?"
"Please." She handed it over and I unscrewed the lid.
"It might be a bit cold by now. Sorry about that. Hope you don't mind sugar. I never used to take it myself until the dentist whipped my teeth out and put falsies in. Then I thought, well, Ethel, where's the harm? Stick 4 sugars in if you like." I said to Bert, "Stick 4 sugars in, didn't I, Bert? Still, if you get to 87, I reckon you're entitled."
She talked while I tipped my head back and poured about 0.5 liter of glorious lukewarm sweet tea down my throat. Tasted like the elixir of life. I handed back the thermos as the bus pulled up. "Ethel," I said, "you're a bloody star." She smiled nervously. I stood back to let everyone on the bus first, but as one, they waved me on ahead of them. No one else boarded. For some reason, they all waited for the next bus.
Chapter 8, June 19th, 1978. The last 7 days have been so surreal, it's as if they happened to someone else. This is the first chance I've had to gather my thoughts and write something. We got the call on Monday morning, just as Father was about to leave for the university. We walked to the underground together most days, so I was already opening the door when the phone rang. The morning sun hits the front of our terrace, and as I stood in the open doorway, light streaming in, couldn't help noticing how old he looks now. I had hoped the ABOS project would give him a new passion, a new reason to get up in the mornings, but the way it had ended had sucked the energy out of him still further. I have an awful feeling that the only reason he puts any effort into keeping going is because I'm here and he doesn't want to let me down. Which is ironic, because the only reason I'm here is to stop him sinking into a pit of alcohol-fueled depression from which he'll never emerge. We've trapped each other. The phone call changed everything. It was a short call, during which he nodded and said, "Yes," a number of times. The only other words he said were, "What do you mean, he?" He put the phone down with shaking hands and looked at me with a spark in his eyes I hadn't seen for years. "That was Ainsley. Station is sending a car for us. The project is to resume with immediate effect. There has been a development." I heard the car draw up in front of the house, but after 9 years of looking at that container of blue-green slime without a single visible change, I wasn't going to let Father get away with, "There has been a development." "What do you mean? What did he say?" Father guided me out of the hall and down the steps to the waiting car. "Ainsley referred to ABOS as he. And when I questioned him, he said, oh, wait and see." As the car pulled into the traffic, I put my hand on Father's arm. "Have you considered the possibility that
after all these years of sacrificing a promising scientific career, Mike may have lost his mind.
Yes, said Father. I have.
No one would have been surprised if Mike Ainslie had slipped over the fine line between sanity and insanity. Either out of loyalty to the project, commitment to the advancement of knowledge, or because of the problems he had interacting socially, Mike had spent more time than anyone with Abos. He was paid to go in 6 mornings a week, record his observations, and prepare the report for the quarterly meetings. Up to now, a photocopy of the last meeting's report would have been sufficient, since nothing ever changed. Despite that, Mike once admitted to me that, more often than not, he came in on Sunday mornings unpaid. He couldn't explain why. I have a soft spot for Mike, but I would be lying if I didn't admit I feel sorry for him. There's a little of the savant about him. A brilliant brain, but a limited understanding of how to relate to others. And putting modesty aside for a moment, I would have to be a complete dullard not to notice the way he looks at me. So my mood, as I took the familiar lift with its industrial beige carpet down to the labyrinthine complex of tunnels, labs, dorms, and who knows what else, was a little ambivalent, to say the least. If this was Mike losing his grip on reality, rather than a bona fide breakthrough with Abos, it might just tip Father over the edge. For 3 months after Mother died, he was in a place so black that I almost lost hope of his ever coming back. If he were ever to find himself back there, I doubted he would recover. Mike met us underground as the lift doors opened. His frenetic manner and unkempt appearance did nothing to dispel my worries. He grabbed Father's sleeve and practically dragged him to the lab, such was his excitement. He was gabbling non-stop as we half-walked, half-jogged to keep up with him. I don't think he finished a single sentence before a new thought hit him and he plunged into another. The effect on the listener was very much like that of trying to tune the radio to listen to the news. Words and partial sentences flew out of him as if he were possessed. I stopped trying to understand after the first 30 seconds. The lab was a 5-minute walk away, but that day it felt like an hour. The whole experience was like a dream one might have just before waking, when your mind is hovering around the border of consciousness, telling your sleeping self that this can't be real. I started to wonder if I was about to wake up and find myself at home. Then Mike opened the door, and I saw what had brought on his manic behaviour. I grabbed Father's arm to steady myself. He had become rigid, staring straight ahead. I only realized he had stopped breathing when he finally let out one long breath in an explosion of air. Mike stood back as Father and I approached the metal table. The cylinder was smaller. That was the first thing I noticed. The top of it had always obscured the clock on the far wall of the lab. Now I could see the time clearly, 8:17. It was so quiet that I could hear the second hand ticking as we reached the table and looked at Abos. Father slowly and deliberately removed his reading glasses from his jacket pocket before staring at what had, just 3 days earlier, been a blue-green mass of mushy pea-like slime. What had replaced it was bigger, maybe twice the size of the slime it had replaced. And the transparent interior of the cylinder was now a viscous liquid, surrounding and supporting its occupant. Bigger, came a voice from the door. Neither Father or I could look away. Mike repeated it.
Bigger. He's bigger than he was even a few hours ago. He's growing.
What we were looking at was a hairless human body, tucked into a loose fetal position. The fetal comparison was further justified by the softness of the shape. The unfinished nature of the hands, feet and skull, the lack of definition. The body we were looking at was still forming, veins visible just beneath the translucent skin, stretching thin red threads of blood out from the hub in its chest. A gentle, hypnotic, rhythmic pulse emanated from a still-developing heart. Father and I stood in mute awe for a few minutes. Then we both bent down to look more closely. The body was roughly the size of a 12-year-old. As if reading my mind, Mike spoke again.
He was about the size of a toddler when I came in. I think he's feeding on the container.
Then I saw the umbilical cord. Instead of connecting the fetus to a host, it floated alongside the body. But the cylinder was smaller than it had been 3 days earlier, and the body was growing, so Mike's guess was probably a good one. Father was near the head. He looked long and hard at the face floating just a few inches from his own, his eyes misted with tears. I knelt and pressed my face close to the edge of the container. Abel shuddered, and I gasped at the unexpected movement.
The change of position caused something to loosen and shift before it drifted into my field of vision.
"Oh, my,"
I whispered. At least one mystery had been cleared up beyond any doubt. I knew now why Mike was insisting on referring to Abos as he. The rest of the day was a bit of a blur, as were the two that followed. Abos continued to grow, and we watched his development with fascination hour after hour. Observation is still the limit of our involvement, as the surface of the cylinder is impenetrable as ever. There has been a 12-degree rise in temperature, but that's all we know. The heightened atmosphere around station has infected everyone. McCain and Roger are behaving as if they never exchanged a single harsh word. Mike can't stop grinning. Father has taken charge in assigned tasks, leading the team with calm, firm assurance. Only I can tell he's as excited as a 4-year-old on Christmas Eve. Hopkins came and barked questions at Father that first morning before disappearing for a few hours. Father couldn't answer many of them. When Hopkins asserted that the scientific team had failed in their duty, since they couldn't explain what had happened, Father calmly reminded him that Hopkins himself had supported the budget slashes leading to this situation. If the budget had been maintained, video footage would be available of the transformation. The moment the familiar blue-green slime began changing into a human shape. Since the cuts, a still photograph taken by Mike each morning is all we have. An argument ensued. Father has the flexible, curious, passionate, intellectually rigorous mind of a true scientist. He argues beautifully. There's no other word for it. Unfortunately, when arguing with someone who operates within certain limits, someone who delegates much of his thinking upwards within a military hierarchy, a well-presented logical argument is next to useless. It always meets the same response.
Because I said so.
And as Hopkins is in charge, the conversation is over. Hopkins posted 4 guards in the lab and 2 more outside the door. We all feel uncomfortable around men with loaded guns, an uncomfortable reminder of who pays our wages. Tonight, Wednesday, is the first time we've been back in the house since Monday. We slept in the dormitories, after sending home for clothes and toiletries. Abos's development had been so rapid that we didn't dare risk missing the next stage. McCain's theory has become the model the team is adopting at that moment. He thinks the cylinder acts just as an egg does to a baby bird. Whatever the thick liquid is inside the cylinder, it must provide energy for the growth of the body. Measurements taken every 15 minutes confirm that the container is shrinking as the body grows. At the rate this was happening, McKean predicted the cylinder would disappear by 6 p.m. yesterday. For much of Tuesday, it looked like he would be right. We all watched as the body grew. We've been filming since Monday, as our budget has not only been reinstated but increased. The team has been gathering video footage. This led to another argument with Hopkins, this time with Roger on the losing side. To be honest, argument is too strong a word. Roger suggested we send copies of the footage to his colleague in New York, a brilliant biologist. Hopkins flatly refused. Roger pushed, making demands, insisting Hopkins was standing in the way of the progress of science. Since Monday, I've noticed Roger sometimes acts as though he's auditioning to play the role of Roger Sullivan in Abos the movie. It's quite disconcerting and more than a little childish. Anyway, Hopkins slapped him down so hard he barely said another word until this morning.
Mr. Sullivan, I want you to listen to what I'm about to say as if your life depends upon it, because it does.
Roger paled.
When you joined station, you signed several documents. One of those was the Official Secrets Act, which forbids you communicating any aspect of your work here to anyone, ever, without written permission from the commanding officer. Which is me. Should you break those terms, you will be committing an act of treason. Outside these walls, a conviction of treason might lead to a significant period of imprisonment. But, since you also signed a document accepting secondment to station, which is part of the British Army, any transgression will be dealt with by a military court, convened by me.
Roger had impressively paled still further. We were all silent by then. Each of us had signed the same documents.
Let me assure you that I will deal robustly with any treasonous act that takes place under my command. And, just in case you're confused about what that means, allow me to clarify. Step out of line and you will never see the sun again, Sullivan. We have cells right here. Station has certain discretionary powers granted by Her Majesty's government, and I will use them without hesitation if security is compromised. Is that clear?
Roger nodded. I was terrified, so goodness knows how he must have felt.
The atmosphere was more than a little muted after that. Towards late afternoon, we watched Abos and the cylinder, wondering what would happen next. The word cylinder was inaccurate now, as minute by minute it had moulded itself to the shape of the body it contained. By tea time on Tuesday, the container around Abos looked like an aura surrounding him, a crude outline about 4 inches away from his skin. It was very similar to what happens when I first remove my glasses. Anyone more than a few feet distant has a blurred outline for a few seconds until my eyes adjust. What made Abos more unnerving now was his movements. It was like watching some kind of slow-motion modern dance, graceful at times, at others awkward and almost painful-looking. He would stretch out his limbs, raising his arms over his head, fingertips reaching towards the edge of the table. When he did this for the first time, we realized how tall he was. The table is 8 feet long, and Abos nearly covers the length of it. I'm ashamed to admit I let out a little scream when I witnessed it. I pretended to sneeze afterwards, so I may have got away with it. Not that I was the only one to react. Roger took a step back. McKean's massive eyebrows went so high they looked like they were trying to catch up with his receding hairline, and Mike actually giggled. Father was outwardly calm, although his hand was shaking a little when he checked his wristwatch. The movements that followed that initial stretch turned out to be a sequence, repeated twice every hour. There were more stretches, contracting and extending muscle groups in the legs, arm, chest and back. There were sudden jerks of the arms and legs. The muscles in the neck flexed. The whole body turned onto its front before rolling onto one side and then the other. Throughout each performance, Abos's eyes remained closed. The face itself was eerily unformed. All the expected features were present and intact. Eyes, nose, mouth, ears, and so on. He was bald, but there were early signs of hair growth. A dark stubble shadowing his scalp. It was an anonymous face, impossible to describe due to the lack of prominent features. It didn't help that we hadn't yet seen his eyes. As McKean's predicted deadline approached, the process of change and growth slowed. Measurements confirmed that the cylinder was now shrinking at a far slower rate, a few millimeters per hour. We pulled chairs around the metal table and watched. It was oddly like a hospital bed vigil, the main difference being that the body we were watching went through a series of contortions every so often. It was Father, after watching for a few hours, who came up with an explanation for the slowing down of whatever process is underway.
The brain of a human fetus develops most rapidly late in pregnancy. If Abos is developing in a similar way, the growth that is taking place may not have slowed at all. It may even have accelerated. The difference is that we cannot directly observe this period of development. Gentlemen, Cressida, I believe we may be witness to the final developmental stage before birth. What birth might mean for Abos none of us can say, but I suggest we prepare ourselves. Cressida?
I blinked. Father rarely addressed me directly when working. It was as if I were an invisible team member. I knew this wasn't meant as a slight, and I never took it personally. For my observations to remain objective and pure, it was best that I should be almost unnoticed. So when he said my name, I barely reacted at first. Then I blinked again and looked at him. Professor Lofthouse? Never, Father, when we were working.
You did some pedagogical training after A-levels, did you not?
He knew that I had volunteered at the local primary school, although pedagogical training was far too grand a term for it. Mostly I had cleared up paint and glue and handed out milk and biscuits.
If my theory is correct, Abos will need a teacher.
My mouth went dry. Oh, but I have no experience. You need an expert, not... He waved his hand in a characteristic gesture of dismissal.
Hopkins has tightened security. We have no access to any outside agencies. Until that restriction is lifted, we are limited to the skills we have available in this team.
I am to be Abos's teacher. Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and the weekend suggested Father's hypothesis was correct. Abos's visible development continued, but far more slowly. His musculature has taken on definition, and the evidence confirms puberty has occurred. He looks like an athlete in his 20s. A 7-foot athlete with a chest like a bodybuilder. There's something about his face that I find unnerving. Kind of familiarity. I almost said something about it, but it sounded so silly in my head. Is it just me, or does he remind you of someone? I didn't dare say it out loud. We're all spending an unhealthy amount of time down there, I finally cracked this afternoon and demanded we go home and rest properly. Father looks drawn, and I barely know what day it is anymore. Besides, I wanted the chance to write this week up. Father and I have a perfectly good house a few miles away, and Roger's wife and children are only just across the river. We can be back at station within 30 minutes of a phone call. Mike and McKean are both happy to stay in station's dormitories, so Abos will still be under constant observation. It's now midnight on Sunday, 19th of June, 1978. I've unearthed my old box of teaching books and prepared alphabet cards, picture books, and learning games. Impossible to know what to expect, and I feel woefully unprepared. Scared and excited, too, of course. Who wouldn't be? Whatever Abos is, we will be the first people on Earth to find out. And when he wakes up, we'll be the first people he sees. It will be an encounter unlike any other in history. And he might wake up tomorrow, the next day, next week, or next month, maybe next year even, although that seems unlikely given the speed of his early development. All we can do is wait.
Chapter 9. Every day, I learned something new about my increased strength and resilience. After the incident with the razor wire, I experimented with various sharp objects on my skin. It was just as difficult as it sounds. I started small, with a stapler. Positioning it on my forearm, I tried to push down but was too much of a wimp. Despite my experience at Tilkley, I still imagined stapling myself might sting. It was hard to conceive the human brain to allow you to do something painful or dangerous. I even worried about biting off my tongue in pain. In the end, I stuck a copy of 2000 AD between my teeth, turned away, and went for it. I felt the pressure, heard the clack of the stapler, but there was no pain. The bent and flattened staple slid onto the carpet. I tried again, watching this time. The stapler made no impression at all on my arm. Time to up the ante. I went downstairs and fetched skewers, a vegetable knife, and the automatic carving knife. When I got back to my room, I turned my music up a little. It was only 10 in the morning, so it was unlikely Mum would surface, but if she did wander into the bathroom to throw up. I didn't want to have to explain why I was attacking myself with an electric carving knife. The skewer was fun. I was tentative at first, just as I had been with the stapler. I put the point on my stomach and pushed. Nothing. I pushed harder. Still nothing. I stabbed myself harakiri style. The skewer bent double. My skin was fine. Wedging a second skewer between two books on my shelf, I ran at it, jumping when I got close. The skewer snapped. I turned to the vegetable knife. It was a sharp blade. Mum had cut a thumb on it slicing lemons a few days earlier. I tried my leg first. Sitting at my desk, I stabbed myself about 3 inches above the knee. The knife bounced off. I got the giggles. 30 seconds later, I was stabbing myself all over my body, like a frenzied lunatic. One particularly savage attempt produced a tiny pink mark on my neck, which faded almost immediately. I reached for the carving knife, plunged it in, and went to work. I started with a finger, then my upper arm, thigh, and buttocks. Finally, I went for my wrists. I pushed harder and harder. The only result was that the blades moved more slowly, and the motor made a peculiar whining sound. There was a small bang, and the electric carving knife expired in a puff of blue smoke. I unplugged it and hid it at the bottom of my sock drawer. Then I remembered the electric drill. I crawled into the cupboard under the stairs, a torch between my teeth. Actually, my days of being able to crawl into the cupboard were over. I could fit my head and one shoulder inside, but that was it. I shone the torch around the small space. Shoes, the iron, some carpet cleaner, and a hoover. The toolbox was in the far corner, in front of a pile of woman's magazines. I pulled it towards me, but the magazine shifted ominously. I stopped. They didn't fall. Gingerly, I opened the nearest side of the toolbox nearest and gently extracted the yellow and black drill. Back upstairs, I eyed my prize appreciatively. I'd been allowed to use it just once when I wanted to hang a cork board on my wall. A combination of inexperience and plain ineptitude had led me to choosing the wrong length bit. A higher speed than I needed. And an inadvisable section of wall to drill into. I went all the way through the wall into the spare room, taking out the electrical cable on the way. The electrician wasn't cheap, although Mum did have sex with him. So maybe she got a discount, I don't know. The upshot for me was a lifetime ban from power tools until, in Mum's words, there was a shithole of your own to destroy. I fitted the heaviest duty drill bit in the chunk and plugged in, then stuck an old Kraftwerk tape in the ghetto blaster and whacked the volume up. I thought Mum, if she heard anything, might assume it was part of the music, particularly if I made my attempt rhythmical. I wasn't 100% confident, so I started with a toe. A girl at school only had 3 toes on 1 foot, and she seemed to get by fine. If my foot turned out to be less than indestructible, I would, at worst, be a toe down. I could live with that. Pulsing the drill in time to the robots, I attacked my toe with a kind of mad glee. Nothing. No pain at all. I pushed harder and harder, stopping only when tiny flakes of metal flew off the drill. I thought I heard something and turned the music down. Mum's voice.
Keep it down, you selfish bastard!
Good morning to you too. I turned off the tape. After a few minutes, I heard her snoring. I took the drill downstairs, eased as much of myself as I could into the cupboard, and reached over to the open toolbox. I dropped the drill inside. Even as it slid out of my fingers, I knew what would happen. The Tower of Woman's Own. House Beautiful. Hello. Okay. And Cosmopolitan toppled forwards.
Shit!
I tried to stop them, but it was too late. They fell everywhere. About 100 of the bloody things. I just resigned myself to the uncomfortable and annoying task of restacking them when I saw it. Flat against the wall, concealed by the magazines piled in front, was a large brown envelope. Stretching as far as I could, I got my fingertips onto the corner and, by a series of tiny movements, teased it out. I went back to my bedroom and quietly closed the door, listening. She was still snoring. The envelope wasn't sealed. Before I tipped the contents onto my bed, I had a sudden premonition. Mum had always said I was the product of one-night stands, a man she met at a party and never saw again. The few times I had brought up the subject, wanting to find out more, maybe even meet him, she had laughed.
Go ahead, if you like, if you can find him. He was a salesman. Dave? Possibly Steve. Or was it Phil? Or whatever.
You're nothing like him, if that's what you're wondering. He was quite a looker, for a start. Fit. Not a fat waste of space like you. She tried hard to keep that tone of casual cruelty in her voice when she dismissed my questions. But I knew her too well. She was hiding something. And the way she looked sometimes, when I caught her crying for no reason, looking out of the window. She was thinking about him, my father. I spread the documents out on the bed. There are a few letters in there, some pages ripped out of a magazine. But the newspaper caught my eye first, because Mum's face was on the front of them. National newspapers. I looked at the headline and wondered why I had never even considered the possibility before. Knowing immediately it was the truth. Reality can be funny like that sometimes. It can be right in front of you for years, waving its arms, letting off party poppers and shouting, "Over here! Over here!" And you don't notice a thing until you trip over and land in its lap. I walked around my tiny bedroom on the verge of hyperventilating. I opened my window and stuck my head out for a few minutes, then went back to bed. The newspaper was still there. Mum's face staring up at me. Alongside her was a photograph of the most famous man in history. I read the headline again. Super stud knocked me up. Mum and I needed to have a little chat. By the time she surfaced, I'd spread the newspapers on the kitchen table. The magazine articles told the same story and featured coloured photos of Mum, often in her underwear. I felt tired. I would never meet my father. He had died the year after I was born. I knew some people said he'd survived, but they were kidding themselves. How could a 7-foot-tall man hide from the entire world? No. He was dead. The letters were sad and desperate. The first few were replies from the Ministry of Defense, who, politely at first, then more bluntly, asked her to desist making ludicrous claims about a national hero. Letters from 3 legal firms regretted they would be unable to take her case. One firm advised her to get back in touch if her baby started flying around the nursery. They were laughing at her. When Mum finally made it downstairs and saw what I was reading, she stood in the doorway for a few seconds, then bypassed her usual cup of tea in favour for an earlier-than-usual raid on the drinks cabinet.
"Well, you're going to find out sooner or later, I suppose,"
she said as she filled a tumbler with vodka, reached for the tonic water, then changed her mind and took a gulp. "Why didn't you tell me, Mum?" She sat down and looked at the photographs in the newspaper. One of them showed her lying on the bed wearing a black negligee, pouting at the camera. "I had quite the body, didn't I?" I didn't respond. She smiled. "It was good enough to get the attention of the deterrent, so it doesn't matter what you think, does it?" I kept my silence. She took another long swig. Neither of us spoke for 10 minutes. I read about companionable silences. I never experienced that, but I can confirm the existence of uncompanionable silences. The atmosphere in the kitchen was thick with nearly 18 years of bitterness, negligence, regret, and failure. I looked at my mother. The only thing we had ever shared was self-hatred. Now we didn't even have that. The past weeks had seen me change in ways well beyond the physical. I could feel a new feeling of self-assurance every time I got out of bed. I'd found myself looking forward to the possibility of a life where I could make things happen, rather than work on ways to prevent life happening to me in its usual, painful fashion. It was possible that I might even, one day, not be unhappy. Finally, she spoke. "Look, I know this is a lot to take in. I couldn't bring myself to tell you, Danny." "Danny? No one called me Danny. I couldn't even remember the last time Mum had used my name. I had postnatal depression. Could barely bring myself to look at you. Then your nan died, and I had to deal with everything on my own. I know I've been a terrible mother. I know it." I looked up at her. She was actually crying. I felt nothing. "But you have to understand, Danny, those newspapers twisted everything. I only called the army because he didn't answer my letters. They said hundreds of women had claimed the same thing. Didn't stop them sending some bloke round when you were born, though. I saw him at the hospital, looking at you, shining a torch into your eyes, trying to take a blood sample. When I shouted, he left. Bastards." She waved at the photos. "The papers offered me a lot of money to take my clothes off, Danny. A lot of money. And I needed it. We had nothing. Nothing. But I was a virgin before him. I want you to know that." I snorted. Whatever goodwill she was hoping for had been crushed by years of bullying and neglect. I think she knew it too. "Danny, look. Give me another chance, will you? I'll work on the drinking, cut down. In my own way, I've tried to love you. I kept you, didn't I? And we got a roof over our heads. I could have had you put into care. That's what my mates all told me to do, back when I had mates." I looked at her, haggard, ill-looking, her face streaked with mascara tears, eyes puffy and red. She was trembling. I felt myself thaw just a tiny bit. Despite myself, I reached over and took her hand. She was a terrible mother, an awful, appalling, selfish, bitter woman. But somewhere in there was the lost girl who'd found herself alone and pregnant in her teens. And she was all the family I had. Perhaps I owed her one more chance. "Okay," I said. "Let's talk about it. About what to do next." She looked up and the word, "we," the naked, desperate hope clear in her face. She squeezed my hand.
"Do you mean it, Danny? Do you really mean it?"
"No promises, Mum. We'll see how the next few days go. See if you can sober up. We'll talk more." She squeezed more tightly, nodding, not daring to speak. "But I mean it, Mum. No promises." She looked at me strangely. It took me a few seconds to work out what she was doing. Even as a baby, I imagined I'd never seen that particular arrangement of her facial features. She was smiling. She stood up and made me a cup of tea. Another first. But the day wasn't quite finished with us yet. As she sat back down, the phone rang. She half stood up, but I waved her down again. "Let the machine get it, Mum." When the caller left his message, she got up again, in a hurry this time. But I reached across and grabbed her arm. As the voice spoke the words that ended our relationship, she went pale. Then all the strength seemed to leave her body, and she slumped at the table.
"Miss Harbin, this is Barry Grogan from the Mail. I've been thinking about what you told me earlier, and if it's all the same with you, I think I'll come over a wee bit sooner than we arranged. I'm going to drive up tomorrow evening, have a chat with you and your young superhero. Get photos of both of you. I should be at yours by 6. See you then."
Mum said nothing as I climbed the stairs and packed some clothes into a rucksack. I took a rolled-up sleeping bag, some candles, matches, and a map. I lobbed my house keys into the kitchen as I passed on my way out of the front door. I was a few days shy of turning 18. I was alone. I had superpowers. And I had the rest of my life in front of me.
Chapter 10. June 23rd, 1978. One mystery was cleared up today, much to my relief. I'm not going mad after all. For days now, I've been looking at Abos's face as he sleeps, wondering if anyone else was seeing what I was seeing. The resemblance was fleeting at first, but as the days went on and the facial features defined themselves, losing their generic nature, it became harder and harder to ignore what was happening. Finally, I broke my silence when I was sharing a lift with McKean. It was something in his expression that prompted me to do it. McKean had just leaned in closer to Abos, making notes. He studied the face, and I saw his brief look of distaste. I sighed with relief. His reaction confirmed my own observations. "You see it too, don't you?" I asked. McKean looked up at me in surprise. "His face," I prompted. "You recognize it?" McKean grunted dismissively, then looked at me again and shook his head slowly, reconsidering. "I admit there is a strong resemblance," he said, "but it's not 100%. The symmetry is stronger, for example. The cheekbones are much more pronounced and the jawline is stronger. This is the face of a much younger man, a much bigger one too. Also," he grunted again, and I realized he was amused, "his nose isn't broken." We both agreed, as did the rest of the team later that day. Abos looks very, very like Roger. August 27th, 1978. Father and the team have come up with a theory about why Abos looks the way he does. Father presented their findings to Hopkins and some high-level military types in the briefing room opposite the lab yesterday. He's always been a good lecturer, and I could see he was holding the attention of his audience, all older men, sharp-eyed and serious. They made me nervous, but it didn't seem to affect Father.
"During the years since the item was discovered in Marsham Street, we've been trying to amass as much data as possible about it. We have run every conceivable test, and we have exhausted all known methods in our efforts to get a sample. As our reports have shown, nothing has worked. The cylinder's construction is beyond anything of which we are capable, well beyond."
"Russian? Chinese?"
The questioner was a tall, lean man in his 70s. He wore a suit. All six of them, other than Hopkins, were wearing suits, but their bearing gave them away as military.
No.
You're sure of this?
Completely.
Father's tone was confident.